WIOX is supported by you and the following underwriters. 1053 Main Street Gallery in Fleischmann's, designed as a space to support a vibrant and active artistic community nestled within the Catskill Mountains. 1053 Main Street Gallery is located in the historic, renovated Fleischmann's Telephone Building. Open Friday and Saturday from 11 to 5, Sunday from 12 to 4. And by appointment. Information about 1053 Main Street Gallery in Fleischmann's and upcoming exhibitions at 1053maingallery.com. MTC, Margaretville Telephone Company, locally operated and employee-owned. Providers of internet, TV, and phone service for both residential and business customers in the Central Catskills region. High-speed internet for transactions, streaming, remote work, and online education. More than 200 cable TV channels for local, regional, and national news and entertainment. And unlimited local and long-distance phone service. MTC, Margaretville Telephone Company, connecting our communities. More information at mtctelcom.com. Watershed Cafe, Roxbury's front porch on Main Street in the heart of Roxbury. For breakfast and lunch, all sorts of sandwiches, coffees, teas, juices, smoothies, and more. Eat inside, on the porch, or meals to go. Watershed Cafe, Main Street, Roxbury. Open every day at 7 a.m. WatershedRoxbury.com.
Hello, this is Rosina Montana, and I host Various Voices, alternate Thursday afternoons at 2, right here on WIOX Roxbury Community Radio. We're live and local in New York's Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20, and WIOXRadio.org.
Okay, you are listening to WIOX Community Radio live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, 107.5 FM on the campus of SUNY Delhi and everywhere at WIOXradio.org on computers or smartphones. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., and we got Ryan, Zane, John, and Zara on tonight talking about forestry check-in. First Wednesday of the month, check in, see what everyone's been up to. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Yeah, doing well.
Pretty good.
All right. So, what do you guys been up to? Let's start with your off time before we get into the talking shop.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've been pruning apple trees for work, and I've been making the time to prune apple trees at home, too. So, there's a few apple trees that I've been working at, but what I really wanted to do was a lot of these smaller sapling apple trees that I have tubed, I pulled the tubes off and pruned all the other scaffold branches off of them to encourage more of that central leader to reach above the tube. So That was something I did to about like 17 tubes I got. So.
Yeah, I pruned my own as well. Sprayed them though. Yeah, last week, some dormant oil mixed with copper, which is kind of like a 1-2 punch for fungi and overwintering eggs or insects, you know, in those crevices between twigs and stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't spray these trees at all, but I just kind of let them grow. Some of the cuttings I took off, I picked like the biggest, fattest flower buds I can find, and I brought those inside, put them in water, and they just started opening up. So,
oh yeah, that works.
Yeah, I did it with some pears I got, pear twigs I got, and they opened up and flowered and then wilted. But I see it happening with apples. So
I got some gumi coming.
Gumis
should be arriving this month. That would be Aliagnus multiflora, not umbellata, which is on the naughty list in New York State.
Oh.
It's on the invasive species. You're not allowed to, you know, promote it in any way.
Autumn olive.
Don't even try it, John. Come after you. Lock you up. But multiflora is, you know, it's not on the naughty list. And it's a sweeter version, supposedly, of autumn olive, which really wants to grow in our area. So I'm looking forward to it because it seems to not care about my clay, heavy clay soil.
Nice. Yeah, some of the stuff I ordered, bare root, just arrived yesterday. So I got to get it in the ground and probably this weekend.
Yeah.
I just ordered some apple trees, some crabs, wildlife-friendly stuff, and one or two apple trees varieties I thought were neat.
Yeah.
Well, I've been out in the woods.
Out in the woods?
Yeah, believe it or not, out in the woods in my free time a little bit. This weekend, I went over near Rider Hollow and kind of just bushwhacked around to see if I could find any early signs of spring. It's still a little bit early around here, I think, for a lot of the, you know, flowers and even ramps and spring ephemerals to be coming up yet. But I did see some trout lily leaves starting to poke through, very small. But there are a few, and a few mushrooms out there. So things are definitely thawing, and the stream was flowing pretty heavily. So and it was pretty nice out. But other than that, I didn't see much. So probably still got a couple more weeks before we start to see stuff really coming up.
I know New York State changed up all the trout rules for fishing, trout fishing, but April 1st, that usually used to mean the opening day.
Yeah, I mean, even in streams that's changed for year-round fishing, April 1st usually marks when everything switches over to being able to keep a trout or two, depending on what stream you're in.
Yeah. So, any guys been out for that? I haven't.
I have not.
No, not me.
Usually don't. But I saw some people out. Looked like, you know, the crowd was out there.
Yeah.
The typical crowd. I don't know. I've been going for walks in the woods, usually bringing my daughter along in the backpack. She's decided that she loves trees and going for a walk in the woods. She's got to touch everyone we walk by, so the last hike took a while. But found an antler shed. Another one. Not looking for them, but I find them.
Yeah.
Yeah, this time is great because there's no vegetation. There's no snow. And they really stick out on like a gray, drab, wet background. That's what we have abundantly, it seems, right now. So, you know, you could be walking along and spot one 100 yards away pretty easily.
Yeah.
Yeah, I found one on a member's property. So he let me have it, took it home. I never found one before, so
nice.
It's pretty nice. It was in the middle of a field. A four-pointer.
Four-pointer?
Yep.
Yeah. Future big guy?
Yep. Yeah, it's...
Oh, four-point side, you mean? So
on one side,
yeah,
yep.
Yeah, so it would have been a little eight-pointer. Legal. Was a little buck.
He wasn't there, but
yeah. And so you're gonna go after hunting next year pretty hard or what?
Yeah.
Is your first year hunting last year for at all overall, or is it just archery?
At all, yeah. So I got into bow hunting and wasn't successful last year, but that wasn't a bad thing because I just learned a lot. I moved around the property where I hunt. I didn't hunt on public land at all, just hunted on this 10 acres of private land, which is a mix of field and forests, and just observed the deer throughout the year and encountered some young spike horns, which I couldn't legally take a shot of, so I just watched them. But I've moved my tree stand around and just learned a lot about where the deer come in and where they leave and what attracts them, and I think I'll have a better shot this year. So it was exciting.
You have a portable tree stand?
Yep, it's a climbing tree stand. Yeah. So, yeah, getting up in that was kind of a learning experience. I think it might be a little too big for me, though. It kind of pinches my hips, or too small for me, I should say. So, but it works to sit in there for 3 hours. And to buy some extra layers towards the end of the season because it was getting a little bit colder and I couldn't be out there with just a jacket and pants anymore. So, but, yeah, it was real exciting.
Cool. Well, I don't know, kind of more getting into more work-related stuff. On my private time last Monday, I took a drive through northern PA. It's like a three-hour loop of what I did for a different reason. But what I couldn't, forget about as it relates to work in the Catskill Forest is just the abundance of forest industry everywhere going on in northern PA.
Hmm.
I mean, I was on roads I've never been on, roads I've been on before. I ventured past. I wasn't looking for anything, and here I found. I've been by it before, but Deer Park Lumber is the first one I went past, and then another part of my route was seemed like a small pallet mill, just like a mom and pop kind of pallet facility. I mean, stacks of pallets being made, trucks on the road, harvest going on. It just had a totally different vibe than here in the Catskill Mountains. Yet. The forest type is nearly the same. The timber looked comparable. So what's going on there that can't happen here is not going good for us because they got, like I said, there's plenty going on down there.
I think it's a cultural difference. I think people in the Catskills that come here, they don't want any. A lot of people just don't want to see any economic growth like that. And I'm with you. I like to see... diversity of not just people and their intellect, but like businesses, man. I like to see people trying other things, new things, stopping in at some random, pallet mill. Wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah, if I had more time, I would have liked to stop because, like I said, locally around here, a lot of people, especially from this radio show, they're familiar with Gary Mead. And if you've ever been to his sawmill, it was no different than the pallet mill that I drove by, except, Gary's shut down, and this mill seemed active. There was employees, and there was wood being moved, and it's all low-grade material. That's just things that aren't selling here in the Catskills abundantly. It's hard to move it. It affects forest management. It affects forest health. And, those are just the two I described, but I must have seen a half a dozen mills in this northern loop of PA I did. Like I said, it took about a three-hour loop within that state, and I wasn't looking for anything, but that's what I found. And I wish we can do something about that because it wasn't like it was impactful on the, people talk about, well, I don't want it because I don't want to see it, I don't want to hear it, blah, blah, blah. Again, I would compare this to what Gary Mead's doing. It's a small little operation in the backside of town. No one sees it. No one hears it. It's not that impactful. But even if it was, is it really that big of a deal? It's a few more trucks on the road, but it's not a dangerous situation. It's no different than the truck delivering, groceries to your fresh town here.
Yeah, people around here should have a right to make a living, too.
Absolutely. So, it was just apparent that it was abundant. And, to the untrained eye, the woods didn't look any different. And that's, maybe a good thing. Because, again, people think forest industry, they think, big bad things in the woods. Then to the untrained eye, I would say it looked no different than our woods here. To the trained eye, I could look in those woods and see, big differences. Managed cherry stands. You hear about northern PA being the... not so much in the eastern part of PA, but the western part of PA, the valuable of black cherry coming from that part of the world. Mm-hmm. But they were managing it in the east part of northern PA as well, black cherry and red maple, some sugar maple stands. I saw some really nice black walnut grove. I wouldn't call them big stands of timber, but someone was managing them.
Yeah.
Really cool.
Pennsylvania has even a tougher time, I think, in regeneration, meaning growth of young seedlings, because they're south of us. The majority of their state is south of us, which means they don't get winter kill as much on deer. Mm. As soon as you cross into PA, like on from our side, from Sullivan into Wayne or something, it's really browsed, and it's really browsed in Sullivan. But there are places, at least in Pennsylvania, where they do have forest management going on. Privately, we meaning the New York State Ranger School, take a field trip out to Western PA and go to Kane Hardwoods, where they had a silviculturalist on staff and would do seed tree cuts, which I have still yet to see in the Catskill Mountains. A seed tree cut is where you cut it where there's just a few reserve trees, really, of cherry to seed in the area. They're having a tougher time regenerating cherry these days, but that's a different topic. On state land, you know, they break it down into DCNR. What was that? Department of Conservation Natural Resources Agency, which would be like our DEC. But then they have this weird thing called the Pennsylvania Game Commission, which is funded, I believe, by hunters. And that money goes back into putting things up that cost a lot of money, like fences. And that's where you see some cool forests.
I was looking out for that. I knew about those. I surpassed some signage that, stated just of Pennsylvania game lands number blah 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 whatever, but I didn't see any fences from the road, not that they weren't tucked in further back. Yeah. I wanted to see something like that, and that I would have made time to stop and get out and walk around and witness, because I haven't seen that yet.
Well, Ryan, you and I have done the Silva training, and I don't know if, I mean, I assume you probably saw the same thing I did, and they took us on a little field tour to areas that have been fenced in.
Mm-hmm.
In the, was it the Kane Experimental Forest there and around that part there? And yeah, you see a huge difference. I mean, yeah. Inside the fence, there's all kinds of, I mean, shouldn't be any surprise because deer eat a lot of things, but all kinds of different diversity of understory plants and young trees, and then a very, very stark difference just outside the fence. So,
yeah, I mean, there's just a stark difference between both sides of us, between Vermont.
Yeah.
Which is a healthy forest industry compared to New York, and Pennsylvania, which is healthier. I'm not going to say healthy, healthier. In New York, we've engaged in this culture of preservation. That's what last week's show was about with the Aldo Leopold Foundation, you know. Aldo Leopold's, what, the founder of modern conservation, wildlife management. But New York really, back in the late 1800s, went into this preservation mode more so than any other state, probably in the Union, really. And was the first to do it. And I think it was well-intentioned. Coincidentally, I'm reading a book about the history of New York's lumber industry. And the guy is writing in the 1880s. And it's leading up to that. And he is saying how, I gathered from what he was saying, he thought they were going to preserve forest to create a steady supply of timber. Mm. He never mentions anything else, like for recreation or preserving watersheds for to keep the ports of New York healthy. It was all about timber, and God, how many mills there were back then. It's just unreal. The splash dams that they did in the Adirondacks, you know, where they would move logs over wooden splash dams.
Yeah, those are impressive.
And then later to steam locomotives or railroads or whatever, you know, down the Hudson. It's amazing what they were doing. Rafting, they first, you know, originally the Susquehanna, they're rafting logs all the way down to, what is that, Chesapeake Bay?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's crazy. Yeah.
He was talking explicitly about the forest preserve, the idea of the forest preserve?
No, he didn't, because it hadn't been yet.
Well, I didn't know if there was discussion
but
at that
point.
But he
was saying that people
lingering
in the state were talking about
creating a timber.
You know, And now the woods are starting to be managed by trained foresters, right, instead of just exploiting, he said. But what was really interesting was, he says, it used to be called the woods. It's the woods. We call it the woods. And forest is like something mentioned only in poems and poetic things. But now we're starting to call it the forest because it's more all-encompassing and not maybe the woods where we work. Mm. That was a cultural shift. All these things were new. All these that idea was new. You know? But I don't know.
Yeah, I think that what we're talking about is one of the things that makes CFA unique is that we support a thriving, lucrative forest products industry. And a part of our mission is educating members on their management, but also the constraints on what they can do, really, as a consequence of the economy in our area.
Yeah, I mean, right? If you don't have, you're going to have fewer opportunities if you don't have market diversity.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's that simple, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we explain, I mean, the term you're looking for is a working forest. That's what we believe in. You know, that leads to generational impacts on the forest and on your family's working forest. It's kind of like a farm, you know, in a lot of ways.
Private land, private stewardship. What's ingrained in a lot of people's minds is that stewardship only occurs on public land. Those are protected lands. And the private land is construed or it's insinuated that they are vulnerable or not protected, right?
Yeah, but that's not true. I mean, I guess if you know, everybody has an evil mindset, but if everybody has a good mindset, you know, a working land is more powerful. The private landowner holds more power than anyone else and can do more good than anyone else in the public sector can ever do.
Yeah, it's just, you know, those private property rights have been whittled away since the late 1800s.
Yeah.
Some might say that's great, but, you know, if you take into account, what, 62% of New York is privately owned? So, of that 62%, how much is it of an acreage that would be vital to industry, forest industry? Not many. Then, of that is, how many are in towns that have encumbrances against private land through zoning or various codes? You know, how many of them can't manage for not only like firewood, but timber, right? Because the taxes are too high. Right?
Yeah.
So all these things are pretty bad in New York, it seems.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, our farmer boss told me once, and he came from an industry kind of background, so I guess he would know, but he felt that once taxes, on average, hit more than $34 an acre, it no longer made sense to manage for timber. The taxes outgrew the rate of growth, and it all went downhill from there.
Yeah.
Huh. I don't know. That's something to look into, I guess.
I don't know. I mean, they just, I don't know. Go ahead. What are you going to say?
Well, I mean, it's things that I've never talked about. It's not, I didn't grow up around here. I didn't grow up in a pretty rural area. So I was pretty unfamiliar with a lot of these dynamics. But, you know, if you don't talk to the right people, you won't learn these things. You don't really see them. They're not very obvious if you're just driving through. So.
Well, how many kids have visited a sawmill?
Right.
I mean, I didn't grow up near a sawmill, but when I went to one, I thought it was the coolest thing ever. Yeah. That's when it clicked. It's like, oh, yeah, this stuff is made locally.
Mm.
In fact, it's what we have the most of, you know? I mean, they talk about, you don't see as much. Remember when WAC, Watershed Ag Council, was pushing pure Catskills? I feel like you don't see that as much, but, you know, and then they did the wood side of it, too, but for some reason, the wood side hasn't caught on as much as local farm products.
Right.
No, and you know, the only sawmill I ever visited, I grew up around here, you know, was Hanford Mills. It's a museum. So is that what we're presenting to the kids, you know, is the wood products industry is something that was, not something that is.
Yeah.
It's a museum piece. It's gone. It's lost. And we should think about it and not forget about it. But, I mean, that's not the way it is, though. We should be going, taking kids to Green Lumber. You know, walking the catwalk. Really cool facility. They do some tours. There's a catwalk above the whole mill. You can walk above it and look down and see everybody working below you and have a mill tour.
Yeah. I just want to see innovation. That's why it's cool. You know, it's kind of sad that we have all these resources and we're not to our fullest ability. Like, you go to Pennsylvania, you're saying you're seeing sawmills, you know? But it wasn't too long ago the Catskills had a lot of mills, you know? I don't know. I mean, just today we're talking about how, like, it's so ridiculous that we don't have an commercial American chainsaw. You know, what the heck? We're like forest people, and we don't have a chainsaw of our own, you know? Things are like, come on. Meanwhile, I'm reading this book on axes. And it's like every region in the United States had its own axe shape, you know. I mean, they did not really have the axe in the world until Americans created them. The way we know the axe today was an American creation, you know. What the guy explains was, like, if you find a really old axe, right, they have the round hole with the round stick through it, basically, or helve, they call it. And what that does is when you swing, it creates a little jitteriness because there's no weight behind it. So what the American axemen were doing was they'd create a pole, which is a weight behind the bit, which is the bit's the part that strikes the wood, and that balances it. That was like a huge deal. But then there's so many different shapes for different woods, and some people are cutting such big wood, like in the Pacific Northwest, that double-bitted axe was invented there because one side... If you dulled one side, you could do the other. But then you needed a duller side if you were doing branches. You don't want it to just stick in as much. I mean, it's just an amazing innovation. I think that's cool. Mm. You know, if you go to Hanford Mills, you look at a lot of the equipment, which is a water-powered sawmill. One of the coolest things I've ever seen. A lot of that equipment's made in Syracuse, from what I remember. It says it right on it. Mm. I mean, how cool is that? But that book I was reading about New York State's forest industry... I mean, he's just talking about New York is just kicking everyone's butt back then in industry, just killing it, you know. Now, you could say, well, things change. You know, you get roads and railroads. Yeah, but we had the capital to reinvest. They didn't. They had to start from scratch. So whenever says, well, things change, like airfare went south or whatever, brought people. Yeah, but they had to start from scratch. We could have reinvested. Why didn't they? And it's like you said before, like our predecessor there, Jim, would say probably is once the taxes got too much, it just took away that reinvestment, I would think. Anyway, I remember SUNY SF, College of Environmental Science and Forestry, did a study years ago, and the biggest divestment incentive to divest from landowners or to high-grade their timber, to do an unsustainable logging cut, rather, is high taxes. I mean, that's one of the biggest things. So, which doesn't... Like this, why would that surprise you? You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it definitely doesn't surprise me. It's just a shame. Kind of too bad.
It is.
But so it's incentivizing mismanagement.
What's that?
Well, it's incentivizing all the kind of stuff we're against, the high grading and the liquidation type cutting. But
it does. Yeah, it does the opposite of what I think most people would. Believe how they felt about their woods is that they think of their forest or woods as an asset. Mm-hmm. But if you have high cost on this forest, then it's a liability. Mm-hmm. What do you want to do with liabilities? You want to liquidate liabilities.
Right.
You know? So, you sell it off or get rid of it. I mean, it wasn't too long ago people used to buy a woodlot for firewood. Could you imagine? Well, that it would be economically feasible to buy a woodlot for firewood?
I mean, that was recreation and you know, family values was other reasons. But Mike Porter, our board president, who's been on the show, has said it before. That was one of the top five reasons he and Becky bought that plot of land in the 80s in Andes was for firewood.
Yeah. There's this tool that the guy who was on last week from the Aldo Leopold Foundation, Steve Swenson, he gave me this link that the USDA did. It's an acronym, TELE. Basically, surveyed the whole country, and you can search by your region, the Northeast, and you can even toggle it and get even more finer than that to the demographic you want, like small forest owners, which is what we serve. And you're not going to be surprised by the results. Really, is that timber, firewood, any kind of product is on the bottom of the list. And on the top is wildlife management, beauty, scenery, recreation. And what's not going to surprise you even more is even though people want to manage for wildlife, they just need instruction, which I think getting to a more positive note now that we've bummed the hell out of everyone, thanks a lot with the PA study.
So sad.
That was an observation.
No, that's all right. No,
this is what I see.
That's where the Catskill Forest Association comes in, is that I do believe people do want to manage for wildlife. They just need to know how to do it.
Yeah, no, and it's shown over and over. I mean, people have us over just to cut open an apple tree, give it full sun, and go home.
All right, and knowing that these things go hand in hand, they're not directly opposed to one another. And, you know, managing for things like timber or firewood or wood products is not antithetical to managing for wildlife or beauty or scenery. I mean, also, how many view sheds have we cut open? You know, it's like cutting is not, I mean, of course, we say it all the time.
How about ski centers?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's just people, I guess, there's some type of dissonance there where they don't connect the two, or it doesn't, I don't know if they, I don't think anyone's deliberately choosing not to see it, or maybe they are, but I think it's just, you know, for someone to point that out, like, you know, first of all, there's wood products in your everyday life. They're a renewable resource. And in many parts of the forest, they would benefit from being cut open.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. I think so. Zane, you say something?
No, I think it's a hurdle for a lot of people. Good forestry sounds good on paper, but to actually see it in person, I think, is different. So comes up against people's intuitions about it.
Well, the book by Enos, whatever it is, The Age of Wood, you know, he describes in that book, the most powerful line, I've said it before, is, you know, the average person is no more than 6 feet away from a wood product at any time of their day.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's got to come from somewhere. So why not your own backyard?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is a forest-dominated landscape, but, I mean, while we're complaining more, I mean, they're just, you know, in school, I didn't really learn about our trees in the Northeast.
Mm-hmm.
I remember in 6th or 7th grade, the teacher there, Miss O'Brien, wow, her name just came to me, we had to make a collage, you know, where you press it with the plastic and all that, of a leaf.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you had, you know, New Paltz, it's really easy to get different trees because there's, like, everything down there. But that was it. Like, you know, did that one project, and I don't feel like we ever covered the northern hardwoods again. Certainly not the central hardwoods. Oak, hickory, and chestnut and all that stuff, yeah. You know?
Yeah, you learn
about
more
the rainforest.
Yeah, learn more about the Amazon than your northern hardwoods.
Yeah, how do I care about the rainforest? Huge... Like, what am I going to do about it? Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going down there.
You got no tree frogs.
Which, speaking of, actually, I was just over at the, I was invited to, I don't know if any of you guys have ever been over there, the Manhattan Country School, right in Roxbury here.
Yep.
And to talk to some of the sixth graders they had up this week. I'll be back again tomorrow, actually, and doing a session. But, you know, they asked me to talk about forest health or tree health, and I was kind of, this was planned several months ago, so I had plenty of time to think about what to say. And I was just, you know, forest health is so subjective, and but I wanted to kind of, you know, drive some of these points home to some of the students that would be interested in you know, my talk or my walk. And how to deliver that in the right way, because like you said, I don't think I even had any type of leaf project in school or any type of tree identification at all. I don't even remember if we ever even talked about, you know, any type of local plants or trees in elementary school or high school. So, I mean, I grew up in an urban environment, but still, you know, that just wasn't part of my education. And clearly they do things a little bit different over there at the country school, but It was interesting, and the kids really were, you know, they had questions and about the forest, and they were interested in the history, and you know, we ended with identifying using twigs. Actually, I was pretty impressed because the leaves aren't out yet. I collected some twigs. It was raining, so we went back inside, and I taught them 6 or 7 different trees in the northern hardwoods, and they quizzed themselves over and over and over and over again, and they really enjoyed it. So I think, you know, kids are definitely receptive to it, and they want to know, and it helps connect them to place and to know what type of environment they're in. And also it helps to actually speak with someone who's in the field of forestry when you're that young. Because, again, even myself, like I happened to have stumbled my way into forestry, but I had no idea. Even right before I entered forestry school, I was kind of like, I know I'll learn about trees, and I know logging probably has something to do with it, but I really had no idea what a forester did, or what, you know, that there were different types of foresters. And yeah, I just think we could do a lot better exposing youth, or people, young people that are looking to, you know, choose different careers, in the culture of forestry and forest management and, you know, tree identification, just basic skills and out in the woods. So,
yeah, I think tree ID is a skill, even if you don't go into an environmental field. I think it's really good to have throughout your life.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's so many things you can use it for, even if you don't, aren't a forester. Even if you want to just make maple syrup with your kids, your family, you know.
You can't manage a forest unless you know the trees.
Right. Or if you just own land, you're a landowner, and maybe you're not, you know, fully, you don't have a whole management plan, but if you want to burn firewood and you're wanting to know which tree species are the best species to burn, you know, just things that you don't. Or
which ones not to cut.
You want to start building, you know, furniture as a hobby, or, you know, any type of thing like that. It's helpful to know. And also just to know, just because, like, it changes the way that you walk through the forest, you know, knowing what's growing and just, it just sparks a curiosity, and then you maybe want to know why it's growing there, and then you kind of get a little bit more into the dynamics that are happening in the forest, and that maybe eventually leads you into more awareness about management. So,
before, I wish someone would have said this to me, but before having any strong opinion about how the forest is doing, first learn the names of the trees.
Then
once you know that, then you can learn other things about those trees, like what they like or don't like, and then you can see how they interact with each other. Until then, it's a green blob.
Yeah,
it's pretty. It looks cool from a clifftop, but it doesn't make any sense. Because I remember what that was like. I mean, that's what's so cool about the forest. Even now, is it's like I still feel like, you know, there's so much to learn. It's just so complicated. But I remember what it was like before you knew the trees, and it was worse. It was a lot worse. It was like, I just want to see trees, and the more the better. And it was like, I didn't know. If you would have told me that certain trees are doing good and certain trees were not, I would be like, I don't really know what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah, and as a freshman in the environmental field, you look at the green blob and you think you know more, but you don't.
Yeah.
You don't know that till start to learn trees, and that blob takes on different dimensions and shapes, and you learn about all the stuff that's going on, how complex it is.
You could say the same about wildlife, right? I mean, when you say wildlife, it's like, which ones?
Yeah. They start with the charismatic megafauna, right?
Right. I mean, it's good for who? For what? For squirrels? Gray squirrels? Well, you don't have an oak tree, pal, so... Too bad, you know? You got some spruce, you're going to have some red squirrels in your attic soon, that's all. Get used to it. If you got Norway spruce next to your house like we saw today.
Yeah. He said it without saying it, he had a problem.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday. Tonight is Forestry Check-In, like we try to do every first Wednesday of the month.
It's a beautiful morning. I think I'll go outside for a while and just smile. Just to get some clean, fresh air for me.
No sense in staying inside.
If the weather's fine and you've got the time, it's your chance to wake up and plan another brand new day.
with robins and flowers. Sunshine caresses each new waking hour. Seems to me that people keep seeing more and more each day.
Gotta say,
lead the way.
It's okay.
Wednesday, gotta say, it's okay.
Alright, just trying to brighten people's day up after the rain and our talk on how bad the economic climate is in New York State. With that being said, you know, I love the Catskill Mountains. I wouldn't be here if I didn't. And I remember the first time you were talking about, we're talking about the green blob off the air of trees out there. I mean, I grew up in Ulster County my whole life. I've been here, and I didn't realize how much forest there was until I went to Giant Ledge one time and just stood out there. You guys have all been to Giant Ledge, right?
Yep.
And I was, and this is in Ulster. You're looking at mainly Ulster County there. Woodland Valley's below you, and you can see, you know, the whole Burroughs Range and then out to the Ashokan Basin. And that's when I realized that true sense of that word, realized, wow. This is really forested place, man. I mean, it's crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, and now we can cheat on Google Earth. I mean, my house is like the only opening in that basin between the Catskill Mountains and the Rondout River. And it's crazy. You know, so we got plenty of trees. We can debate quality, but our quantity is just, it's through the roof. Mm-hmm. So we're doing good in the quantity category. Mm-hmm. What do you think? Quantity?
I agree.
Quality?
We have an abundance.
I might have said this on the air once before. I talked to a guy, met him at an event, barbecue, whatever, private thing, and he was someone's, a woman I know's guest, so he ended up being from South Dakota, and he had a hobby farm. Ended up, he said his hobby farm was 5,000 acres. So that's about what you get for a hobby farm in South Dakota. Oh. And he told me, because this is his first trip to the Northeast, and he said, if anybody ever tells me again that I can't cut a tree on my hobby farm, I'm going to send them out your way, because New York has enough of them.
Yeah.
I said, I agree. We should cut some trees here.
Yeah. And that's just New York.
Yeah.
Like Ohio, as many millions of people that are there, it's very forested, you know? Kentucky, you don't have to go through the states, but you get the point.
Yeah.
It's just crazy, you know? So, I don't know. A lot of trees out there, but, oh yeah, so what you guys want to talk about last 15 minutes? Let's talk about our wildland firefighting refresher, and yeah. Actually, Zara, you went to Virginia recently, right?
Yeah, I did. I went to a conference down there, Appalachian Forest Farmer Coalition put on, so it was a forest farming conference. It was called Gather to Grow, and it was in Roanoke, so kind of in western Virginia, a lot of forest out there as well, and I learned a lot. I mean, a lot of the stuff that they, you know, the workshops and things, they were all forest farming focused, and so a lot of it I was kind of familiar with already, but I met a lot of interesting people who are, there's a much more rich history of forest farming in Appalachia. And, you know, there's a lot of culture around it down there. And so it was really interesting to hear people who are native to that area kind of talk about, you know, I mean, maybe not so dissimilar from the Catskills, but, you know, growing up with their grandfather and going out and looking for ginseng and digging ginseng and, you know, the culture around those types of forest botanicals, golden seal, bloodroot, black cohosh down there. And the markets down there seem to still be thriving, and people are interested in reviving it in places where it maybe isn't so thriving anymore. So that was definitely very interesting, and it was cool to explore some ginseng habitat in that region, which is a little bit different from here. Mostly tulip poplar when you get down there. I mean, there's sugar maple as well growing, but it seems like sugar maple in the south, or at least in that area, I can't speak for you know, the whole south, of course, but in that area seems to be a little more generalist than maybe it is here, where here we see it mostly confined to the best sites in the forest. Down there, maybe it seems to grow a little less predictably, but it does coincide with tulip poplar or yellow poplar, spice bush, and then that was my first time encountering that. I think we really only have that in maybe the Hudson Valley and some limited parts of the interior Catskills here. But that was my first time encountering spice bush. They have pawpaw growing in the wild there.
Oh, wow.
They have...
that's neat.
Yeah, that's pretty... It's pretty... I mean, in some cases, it seems like my impression from people talking about it seemed almost like a nuisance. They're like, oh, this pawpaw is growing here. And I was like, that sounds pretty cool to me. Like,
if only we can be so lucky.
Well, pawpaw sends up... we saw one tree. It wasn't in the forest. It was out in a riparian's open area. But... It sends up, I don't know if they're root suckers, but it sends up lots of shoots. So I can see, I guess, how it might be similar to some other species, maybe like beech, where it can form a little thicket or kind of clone itself. But anyway, I thought it was cool. I saw some mulberry, too, that had been planted in a field by a farmer there, connected, I think, to Virginia Tech, their sustainability center out there. So... yeah, lots of different interesting things. And then there was actually a few people up from the northeast, or down from the northeast, I should say. So we had breakout sessions, and I was able to connect with some people who are up in this area doing forest farming. So it was interesting. It was a good weekend. Long drive.
How many vendors there, you think? How many people in the...
Well, they didn't have a too big of a kind of a vendor section, I guess, but... there were a lot of different farms and organizations selling, you know, their memberships or their wares from the forest, stuff like that. But mostly it was just people who were there to present. And there was a lot of different talks. I couldn't possibly go to all of them. There was many that were happening all at the same time. So you kind of had to pick and choose what you were most interested in. So I tried to stick to things that would be most applicable up here, learning more about ginseng, learning more about best practices in forest farming, you know, marketing, things, information that I can pass on to landowners in our forest farming program or, you know, things like that. So,
cool.
And speaking of the wildland fire training, if we want to talk about that next, sure. I did pass some wildfires in Virginia that I didn't know were happening until I started... I was on the highway, the interstate there, and the air started getting real thick and smoky and pink colored, just like those few days of smog that we had last year. And I was like, this kind of reminds me of wildfire smoke. And then lo and behold, I'm on the interstate, and I look over to my left, and on a hillside there, I saw one of the brush fires going on. So that was interesting, but nice. seemed contained. I don't know.
Cool. Yeah, we did our refresher course for working towards volunteering on prescribed burns on state land, and we also did our PAC test recently. So that was kind of a physical test for people who wanted to fight fires with the state or around the country. And
this is wildland fire training, right?
Yep, wildland fire training. So.
Put on. We did it in New Paltz, Region 3 office, right? And mm-hmm. You did it, where, Zara?
I went up to the Albany Pine Bush, so I think that's Region 4 up there, but with Tyler Briggs, who's been on the show before.
Yep. Yeah, yep. And they showed us a video of the South Canyon fire again.
Yep, very unfortunate circumstances added up to mass casualty on the mountain.
Yeah.
So, but... You know, what we kind of learned and what everybody agrees upon, and maybe it was a fire that shouldn't have been fought, and maybe there's a lot more of those out there. I know, I said it, let them burn.
It's a hard thing to say or admit, yeah.
But there are fires that, you know, in natural ecosystems that have historically burned, maybe we shouldn't be there, you know. It's too dangerous, and its net benefit for the ecosystem is there.
As one forest ranger said, you know, maybe should have made a bigger box.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right, for the fire line, and just let it do its thing instead of going with a direct attack from the top. Mm-hmm. But they did the same, you know, in Napanock fire recently, you know, which happened in Ulster County last year. You know, the whole goal is to suppress that thing. And it's like, I don't know. That to me is kind of depressing, because I thought, you know, 20 years ago, we were going to, you know, let wildfires go if property wasn't in danger. And that one is really not. Sam's Point owns to the top there. And not only that, but that one wasn't even caused by humans, which is less than 3% of fires are caused naturally. That was actually lightning. So, double whammy, I think.
Yeah.
And you know what? Okay, I'm going to say one more thing. I got to say it. What really pisses me off is that you're not even allowed to pick cranberries in Minnewaska State Park. And you can't even camp there. And then the amount of machinery they use to fight this fire.
Bulldozers.
That I saw. Yeah. The water bars, I hope, are coming. Because if a logger did that on private land, the DEC would shut it down. Maybe fine them, I don't know. There is streams around there that... That one doesn't have a trout stream near it. Well, as you go further down, yeah, that one could have trout. But it's just, I don't know. Especially when there's carriageways and stuff. But it makes you wonder. I thought the philosophy was changing on that.
Yeah, well, these are ecosystems too, especially down in that area, right, that have, like, regular fire return intervals. Like, it's part of the, as John was saying, the natural ecosystem. And there may actually be major benefits to it. It's not even like, oh, we shouldn't get involved because we're endangering lives. Like, that's important too, right? Is there property involved that, you know, matters more than a human life necessarily? Or it's not even that. It's like, maybe it's actually good for the forest there to be burned, you know, once in a while, especially if it's, you know, like you said, caused by lightning or something. It wasn't even a human-caused accidental quote-unquote fire. So,
well, after our training, you know, about wildland firefighting, it makes you wonder how much dangerous it is if it doesn't burn. The mm-hmm. amount of fuels
right,
that are building up on the Shawangunk Ridge. If you thought it was dangerous after the fire, it is much more dangerous before it. Because if you had been up there hiking, you may have been screwed. I mean, it'd be hard to get out of there. You know, I remember I had a friend, he's got squatter's rights on the ridge, and he built it in the 60s. And the old forest ranger, Ray Wood, his last name was Wood. He was very well known. Such a friendly guy. You could walk in, he just talk to you. But Wood told him that, you know, you're not going to be able to outrun it up there. You got to find, like, a crevice or something, because you're not going anywhere. He's 3 miles from, and it's just azalea and rhododendron and laurel and cliffs and blueberry. You just can't run. You know, you can't run like you can through our forest. There's litter everywhere, and they can get ladder fuels because there's that mid-story of brush that can connect the stunted trees that are maybe 20 feet tall. You can get canopy fires. So it's like, it's just, it can actually have, that's the one area you could have a serious fire. Mm. You know, not necessarily where we are here in Delaware County, but
yeah, definitely heard that in discussion as a point of concern of buildup of fuel on the forest floor. Because, you know, historically, especially in those areas, burning was happening very regularly, and so it wasn't as dangerous if something caught fire because, like you said, there wasn't maybe those ladder fuels to connect the understory to the canopy and to make the burn so severe.
That's what Bob Williams said when he was on our show, Forester from New Jersey. New Jersey has a similar forest, the Pine Barrens, that's similar to the Shawangunk Ridge. He said at this point there's places that you couldn't just burn. They'd burn too hot. There's too many fuels, and they would have to silviculturally remove material now before doing a burn. which is interesting.
Yeah. It can't be cheap.
No. And it circles back to what we were saying before. It's not cheap if you don't have market diversity in low-grade products, products, right?
Yeah, you got to work backwards before you work forwards in a situation like that. We did tree shelter training. Fire shelter.
My God.
Fire shelters.
Imagine crawling into a fire shelter.
So these are single-use type materials that, in the event, is a last-ditch effort. If you're trapped in a fire, you deploy it, and you cover yourself, and you lay as low to the ground as possible. And it's meant to keep radiant heat from overheating you. You train on those, and that's part of the training.
Well, let's hope you never have to go in one of those.
All right.
Jeez. So that's it. We're official. We're ready for wild and
ready to volunteer.
Yeah.
Ready to volunteer.
Now, our goal with that is to, volunteer and prescribe fires, right? And I'd like to do a suppression. If there's one in Ulster County again on the Schwalink Ridge, I would definitely like to because I've always wanted to see fire.
Yeah, I think you can just show up, I think, to those types of and off, say I'm certified FFT2 or whatever, and you can say, if you need help, I'm here as a volunteer. At least that's what a forest ranger said to me.
Yeah.
So
they'll be like, you're certified, all right.
He's just like, all right, watch my truck.
I'm certified. I'm here to help.
We hope to be on a burn. Hope to be on a burn and learn from that experience and see how they do it and take that back to membership.
Well, we're coming up on the, seems like I was up at the Pine Bush, and I think they said, which is interesting to me because it's in the middle of the burn ban for New York State, is the peak of their prescribed burn season. So they do a lot in May.
Ironic. Well, that's all the time we have on From the Forest next week. I believe we're interviewing, what's his name?
Chip Beck.
Chip Beck, about his maple sugaring operation into backyard maple sugaring, right?
Yep. He started with 3 or 4 taps last 2 years ago and got the maple bug and went up to 55 and the real evaporated. So we're going to learn about his increase in his first year.
All right. Have a good night.
Thanks.
The sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way, getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year. Flowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games. In an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town.